Made possible with support from Radio Maria and Downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring performances by the gifted jazz saxophonist Joshua Redman and his quartet, and the reggae-funk-afro-Cuban mix of the Chicago-based band Funkadaisy. Visit KrannertCenter.com for more information.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the relationship between personal history and political leadership. Our guest is historian William Chafe, a professor of history at Duke University. His most recent book is Private Lives, Public Consequences: Personality and Politics in Modern America. It is a collection of 8 biographical essays about American political leaders of the 20th century, beginning with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and concluding with Bill and Hillary Clinton. In addition to FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt and the Clintons, William Chafe's essays profile Martin Luther King Jr., John and Robert Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Ronald and Nancy Reagan. In the introduction to Private Lives, Public Consequences, Professor Chafe says his essays are an effort to understand what has molded the direction, the personality, and the life choices of those who have become our national leaders, and how, in turn, they have molded the direction of the nation. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, William Chafe, is Alice Mary Baldwin Professor of History and former Dean of the Faculty at Duke University. Private Lives, Public Consequences, Personality and Politics in Modern America is published by Harvard University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Chafe, thank you so much for joining us this
afternoon. Thank you for having me, and glad to be here.
You say you began these essays with this premise, that individual leaders make a difference. And you also say that that premise was a departure for you. Your interest as a historian is focused on social movements. What led you to change focus and for these essays?
Well, I had written a number of books on the civil rights movement and on women's history and the women's movement, and one of the things that I think became clear to me was that at particular moments in history, an individual exercises incredibly important influence on the direction history takes. And that led me to write a biography initially of Alan Lowenstein, who was a liberal reform activist in the 1960s who organized the Dump Johnson movement and was probably as much as anyone else responsible for Lyndon Johnson withdrawing from the presidential race in 1968. And also that particular biography gave me a sense of how individuals at different moments in their lives absorb things from their past and then act on them. So looking at the history of individual leaders, I became intrigued by the way in which the intersection occurs between social movements and particular political leaders. And you could look at John F. Kennedy as an example of that, and how his actions at a given moment helped to make possible what a social movement had really demanded of him.
In general, what would you like to say at the outset here about the range of experience in childhood and in young adulthood of the leaders you've profiled and how that affected their strengths and weaknesses later in life as leaders?
Well, I think that one of the thoughts I had was if you sort of sat down with a group of people in a kind of open discussion group and asked them, what do you think is most likely to be present in a person's background if they're to be successful, they would probably say, well, economic security, you've got to be well off to have a good education and a happy childhood. B, nurturant and loving parents. C, a fairly stable emotional life and a sense of moral direction. In addition to happy parents, happy relationships of your own, and the ability basically to sort of go through life based upon those foundational experiences. And I think one of the things that was really quite surprising was the degree to which, in the case of these individuals at least, that generalization simply does not hold forth. You've got three people I read about who are the children of alcoholics. Four of them come out of economically marginal backgrounds. They're not middle class or upper class. There's a great deal of dysfunctional family life and unhappiness among the parents. And then in most cases, there is a very, very serious problem in their own personal relationships and in their own unhappy marriages. So what I concluded from that was that one of the things that's most important in looking at leadership is how do people overcome adversity. Adversity is kind of the single common theme through these stories. And that led me to think that as we look to politicians in general, it's probably important to ask what have been the adverse circumstances in their lives, how have they dealt with those, and what can we learn from their experience with adversity?
Yeah. You know, as we look out over the political landscape today, then are there things we can learn about someone's potential as a leader by taking a look at his or her personal life, what their background is?
I think there is. It's something which we have become much more comfortable with and familiar with of late, particularly the post-Watergate era. I mean, one of the things that's most fascinating is that most Americans, believe it or not, were not aware of the fact that Franklin Roosevelt could not walk. They had never seen him in a wheelchair. They had this image of a man standing at a podium with a cigarette holder and this big smile on his face. They did not know how totally immobilized he was. Clearly, most Americans never knew that John F. Kennedy had a very serious problem of womanizing and philandering. But really, in the post-Watergate era, almost anything, as we now know from almost too much exposure, almost anything is fair game. So I think it's important to find out what a person's growing up has been like and what their personal experiences have been and whether there have been crises or moments of a real challenge in their lives and how they've dealt with those challenges and then what that tells us about their character and their way of dealing with difficult circumstances.
Yeah. To what extent do you think, though, that everything's fair game now, it seems. To what extent can that examination of somebody's background become a crisis for that individual? And, you know, there's another possible burden and something that has to be faced, to be dealt with.
Oh, I think it easily can happen. I think, frankly, that if Bill Clinton had not had the problems that he created for himself with his private life, he would have been a much more successful public personality. On the other hand, I think that that's something which he could have dealt with in a different manner. He could have been more candid. He could have been more straightforward. He could have dealt more honestly with these questions. And had he done so, he would have been much more successful. So it was, I think, it was important to kind of recognize those characteristics.
Hmm. You mentioned alcoholism playing a role in the lives of a number of these individuals that you profile. The book begins with the essay on Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and ends with the one on the Clintons, and in between are the Reagans. And in each story, alcoholism plays a role.
Yes.
Eleanor's father, an alcoholic. Bill Clinton's stepfather, Roger Clinton, an alcoholic. Ronald Reagan's father, an alcoholic. A couple of questions here. How did that affect them as they were growing up? And how did it mold them into the adults they would become?
Well, there are three separate stories there, although there are some unifying themes. Eleanor Roosevelt had a tragic childhood. And most Americans don't realize that. Both her parents died by the time she was 10 years old. Her father was a person with whom she had almost a magical relationship. She loved him so much. He would toss her in the air in the morning, and he wrote about their taking long rides in a sled in the winter down the hill and being together in nature. And she really was enthralled with him, and she wrote him notes and signed them, "Your own little Nell." But the other side of that was that he was someone who was consumed by an illness. One day he took her to his club in New York City and left her with the doorman and said he'd be right back, and he went off on a binge, and he never returned. So she grew up really with a sense of the fragility of relationship. She wanted to invest very much in a person, and she had with her father, and then it ended tragically. In some ways, with Franklin Roosevelt, she found the same relationship she had with her father. He was happy, he was ebullient, he was gregarious, outgoing, and she fell in love with that kind of magical charm, and she used to sign her letters to Franklin, "Your own little Nell," the same word she used with her dad. And there was a very magical time during that relationship, but it quickly ended. She had four children. They went to Washington. She discovered her husband was having an affair with Eleanor's own social secretary. And she felt once again as though she'd been cut off, just as she had been with her father. And that basically led her to find solace and meaning in her life by service to others and by a public role, by one that she could find her gratification and fulfillment through interaction with women reformers, other friends, with people she was helping to serve. And it actually prevented her from ever restoring the kind of intimate, personal relationship with her husband that had been so important to her before. So it helped to define what her role was in relationship to him. It helped make her an incredibly important political presence in his life because she took his place in so many places after he developed polio. But it also defined the ways in which they played out their respective roles during the entire political career of Franklin Roosevelt as both governor of New York and then president of the United States.
Yeah, it seems that Eleanor and Franklin were two individuals of great determination.
Mm-hmm. They were, and you know, it was a complementary relationship. Even though it had this incredible tragedy of not being able to reach across the divide of intimacy, it nevertheless was one where they served each other's interests in an extraordinary manner. She was able to be his conscience. She was able to talk about the tenant farmers in the South. She was able to talk about the garment workers in the North. She was able to talk about the coal miners, people he couldn't see, people he couldn't meet with. She went out on missions of fact-finding for the administration. And some of their most valuable moments together would come when she would return from a trip and the two of them would talk for hours about what she had found. And those were the moments of togetherness as a couple that replaced the intimacy of a loving romantic relationship. And it served both of their interests. It served Eleanor's because it gave her the kind of sense of commitment and service and gratification that she desperately wanted to put meaning into her life. And it gave Franklin a perspective and an insight that he never otherwise would have been able to have and that oftentimes he acted on. So even out of these tragedies, there developed some very positive sort of results.
Was that able to sustain them through the crises the nation faced during the Roosevelt presidency?
I think it sustained them for a number of years through those crises. I think that the role, her public role, and her political role was very prominent during the first 8 years of the Roosevelt administration. Then when the war came, things got much more difficult because he was so consumed by events of war. She was still doing a lot of traveling, talking to a lot of soldiers and service people and things like that. But there was less time for them to be together, less time for them to share those insights. He had many more needs of finding someone who could respond to his immediate needs for frivolity, for happiness, for more flirtation. And they did come a couple of times during the World War II when he actually raised the issue with her of they're once again resuming a more intimate man and woman, husband and wife relationship. And she considered it, and she finally decided that it just wasn't worth the risk. She couldn't abide the thought of being hurt again in such a manner that had happened with her father and then with Franklin in 1919.
There was an opening for a renewed marriage, if you will, and that was the occasion of two deaths, Franklin's
yes.
mother and Eleanor's brother.
Yes.
Very touching part of the story.
Absolutely. There, the moment when she comes back and learns that her brother has died, and he makes his way to her and takes her in his arms, it's such a touching moment. And it shows the depth of what was there as a kind of ongoing residual presence, you know, and as you say, the fact that she reaches out to him as his mother is dying and makes sure that he's there before she dies, and the way in which they're touching with each other and intimate with each other on those occasions. But she seems just not able to take the chance of making this a more enduring process. And so, tragically, Franklin turns to others, including going back to Lucy Mercer, with whom he'd had the affair and during World War One. And so it's Lucy Mercer who's with him when he dies in Warm Springs. Eleanor does not know that he is seeing her again, but it's a kind of a tragic conclusion to this whole story. Although she, of course, continues her life of extraordinary public service and United Nations ambassador, author of the Declaration of Human Rights for the United Nations, activist in the civil rights movement. But it's ultimately a story of great personal tragedy.
Yeah. At the outset of that affair with Lucy Mercer, you say Roosevelt seemed to relish getting away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another theme here, is leading two lives,
mm-hmm.
something that Bill Clinton also did.
Yes, exactly. One of the things I found most interesting about Clinton is that, you know, in his autobiographical memoir, he actually confronts this issue. And he talks about leading parallel lives and not being able to integrate them. And he talks about carrying with him a series of secrets and not being able to confront those secrets. I found that an amazing kind of acknowledgement on his part of great insight. And yet those parallel lives tell us an enormous amount about both his success and his failure. In many respects, I think that growing up in a household with an alcoholic father, who we really did call Daddy, even though he was a stepfather, an alcoholic father who was also abusive to his mother, where Clinton becomes, in a sense, the rescuer. He rescues his mother from being beaten. He threatens his father that he'll go to the police if he ever sees his father raise his hand again to his mother. And then he basically adopts a series of roles that are essentially designed to kind of bring things together in the family. He will be the rescuer who will make a name for himself on the outside world and bring praise and glory to the family, and he will be able to cast a bright light on the family by virtue of his successes. So he just has this extraordinary career of going out and mesmerizing people and being magnetic and powerful. And from his teenage years, when he's this leader of Boys Nation in Arkansas and goes to the White House and has his picture taken with John F. Kennedy, to his years at Georgetown, and then just getting a Rhodes Scholarship, he's always being able, trying to reflect his own glory back on the family to make things whole, and yet at the same time carrying on this other life, especially after high school, which is full of womanizing and infidelity and disloyalty, which he always keeps secret or tries to keep secret. He may well, as FDR, glory in getting away with it. On the other hand, in the end, it is essentially a self-destructive act, which is crippling. And the degree to which he cannot deal with that, particularly in terms of his relationship with Hillary, is one which ultimately helps to sabotage and destroy his presidency.
Isn't it interesting how some of these individuals, their charisma is, in essence, a mask?
Yes. Yes, that's a very good point, I think. It's, again, the way in which the role one plays becomes the persona that we all recognize and see and identify as natural, but it's also hiding something, and it is a mask, and what's behind the mask is almost impenetrable and very, very difficult to deal with.
Yeah. And thinking of charisma, we've talked now about two very charismatic men, Franklin Roosevelt and Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm. You know, Reagan is, again, a child of an alcoholic who remembers having to basically carry his father indoors because he couldn't get through the door, and trying to make things right, and in a very divided, dysfunctional family. What Reagan, I think, does is to, again, use the process of playing dramatic roles, of playing ennobling roles, as a way of kind of making things right by always identifying himself personally with something which is above conflict, above contradiction and dispute. He's a lifeguard. He, you know, what more heroic role than being a lifeguard? And he rescues 76 people over the period of time. He's a lifeguard. He plays this role of a radio announcer where he's describing a baseball game, which he's getting on the teletype. He's not even watching the baseball game. He's making things up as he goes along, but he's making things right, you know, by the role he's playing. And he does the same thing when he goes to Hollywood and becomes the actor. He actually comes to believe that he was in World War II, even though he never was, except as playing a soldier on the screen. It's something which he is so good at, and he actually believes in all these kind of unifying ideals. And so when he starts making these speeches for General Electric in the 1950s and talks about America as this source of great idealism and equal opportunity and a nation with great pride in itself, he believes those things totally and becomes the part he's playing. And one of the reasons why I think he is such an extraordinary success as a president is that even though he is advocating programs that are very partisan and very divisive and very full of conflict, he is never perceived as a figure of conflict. He is always perceived as the all-American unifier. And as long as he plays that role as someone who will unite people and direct their attention toward the higher ideals of the country, and toward the greatness it can achieve, he generates faith in himself from the American people. There's a wonderful description of him by Tip O'Neill, who's the Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives during the Reagan presidency. And Tip O'Neill says, you know, whatever you think about Reagan's politics, he's a cultural Democrat. He's someone you can imagine having a beer with. He's someone that everyone can relate to. And that he was that. He was that. That's why people loved him, even though they might disagree with his politics. And that's why when he talked about it being morning time in America again in 1984, people kind of believed him because he was so good at playing the part and making people think that it was all real.
Yeah, and we want to see somebody tall in the saddle.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian William Chafe. He's a professor of history at Duke. His latest book is Private Lives, Public Consequences, Personality and Politics in Modern America. It's a collection of 8 biographical essays of American political leaders of the 20th century. FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt, the Clintons, Martin Luther King Jr., John and Robert Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Ronald and Nancy Reagan. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. How self-aware do you think these individuals are? Bill Clinton certainly has a sense of that.
Mm-hmm. I think so, very much so.
You see that in his memoir.
Yeah, and I think that I think he was always aware of it. I think he came to a full articulation of it in the aftermath of the struggles in the White House following the Lewinsky affair. I think Reagan was not terribly aware of these things. I think he was basically content to have his vision, to believe in it, and not to think too much about it or about how he came to it. I think Franklin Roosevelt was an enigma inside of a riddle. I think he just basically no one will ever fully, I think, understand what was going on in his private life. And that in some ways goes back to his experience with polio, as well as going after his child. But he had to find within himself an extraordinary amount of inner strength to both be able to confront the reality of having polio and then to be able to make the determination that he would not accept the easy way of becoming a rich invalid aristocrat, but rather would struggle in every conceivable way to try to regain as much movement in his body as he could and to be an effective, active citizen. But no one ever saw the inside of that and where it all came from. But I think it had an enormous amount to do with the way in which he was able to find the strength to be such a strong leader.
Yeah. You open that chapter, Partnership Unprecedented, with a recollection of his daughter, Anna, that is quite striking. He's got to get, today he has got to get down to the end of the driveway.
Yeah, it's you get a feel from her description and from the descriptions that Jeffrey Ward, one of Roosevelt's biographers, who was also a polio victim, give of his first days trying to go back to a law office in New York, of the unbelievable pressures that he experienced physically and spiritually. And yet, I mean, when he goes to the Democratic Convention in 1924 and to nominate Al Smith, and, you know, with sweat pouring off his body and through his shirt and into his suit, getting to the platform to basically flash that smiling grin and to give this wonderful endorsement of Smith, you get a sense of the personal dynamics that actually you can also see in the way in which he leads the people into World War II.
Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting for us on line one. Listener in Champaign, hi.
Hi. I'm tuning in a little late, but intriguing program. Would you be willing to comment in terms of Reagan, whether the parallels, and you didn't do this particularly in the book, but with our current president, in terms of some interesting parallels there, or do you see some?
I actually do not see that many parallels, because I think that Ronald Reagan had a vision. It was a simple vision. It was a clear vision. He did not get involved in, I think, trying to implement it by mastering details and policy issues himself. He delegated a huge amount of authority to others. I don't think he was an ideologue per se. I think because to be an ideologue is really to embrace one side of a partisan divide. And I think that Reagan, even though he made some enormous changes in America, I think he did not perceive himself as being an ideologically divisive person. I think George W. Bush is an ideologue. I think he has his own vision, but it's a vision that is much more self-conscious and clear-cut and much more devoted toward implementing and accomplishing a variety of dramatic changes that are very clearly in his mind to accomplish. He has an agenda, and it's one which is very, very much a partisan agenda.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener on line four, a caller in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Afternoon. I've just caught part of it, but I think what you say about Ronald Reagan, people identifying with him, is very true. I can remember the first time I heard him when I was about 17, when he spoke at the dedication of the library here in Eureka, and he just seemed like he could, psychologically, he could make the audience regard him as an adopted son. And I think what you say, too, is so true, that he could sort of make people, even though his policies, I think, were very detrimental to their self-interest, like he was above the fray, and he so painted the world maybe in simplistic visions and descriptions that people would rather believe him than maybe think a little bit through him and to what his policies were really doing to them.
I think that's a very important point, and especially if you think about some of his policies towards civil rights and race, where he was very conservative and very opposed to affirmative action and had in office a variety of people who really in some ways helped to undermine some of the progress made toward racial equality. When he said, "I am not a racist. How could you possibly think I'm a racist?" He believed him. You know? I mean, he was completely credible. And he would basically trot out some story. One of the things about Reagan which is so fascinating is that he was a person full of anecdotes.
Yes.
He could tell an anecdote
yes.
for any situation. And it was always one which kind of engaged you, kind of brought you into the conversation, kind of made you feel as though this is a hail fellow well met talking to you as a friend. And that's an amazing quality, I think, that very few politicians really have. Someone like Richard Nixon never had a clue about.
Yeah. I just to affirm what you said, I can remember arguing in 1980 about him really, whether he cared about the poor or not, about others, and they would just almost trot out his antidotes, you know, like the favorite cliche he would use, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party left
mm-hmm.
me. Could I ask one more question? Was Reagan on the record officially opposed to the 64 and 65 Voting Rights Act and Housing Acts of the Johnson administration?
I think he was. I need to go back and check that. But Barry Goldwater was.
Yeah, I know Barry Goldwater.
And I think Reagan. And I think Reagan was at that point. I think opposed.
Yeah.
But I don't have that. Don't have it in front of me. So okay. I don't want to be definitive about it.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign County, line one. Hi.
Yeah, I think that's the triumph of style over substance that we've just heard illustrated there. And even in substantive terms, Reagan was pandering to a very racist right. He kicked off one of his winning campaign by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi.
That's right, Neshoba County, where the three lynchings took place in 64.
So I don't, and he went to Bitburg in Germany and honored the war dead, which annoyed a lot of people, too. I just, you know, I think he was a great actor, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he could play... play it quite well.
Yeah.
I don't know how old you were when he was performing, but many of us saw through it quite clearly. And
yeah.
I just think there's this glorification of Reagan that you exhibit that is tragic.
No, I think that's true. The Bitburg situation is an interesting one because this is an example of the way in which Reagan's fortunes, good or bad, were determined by staff work. He had a great staff during the first administration headed by James Baker, and the interesting thing is that Reagan was willing to reach out to Baker, who had been Senior Bush's campaign director, and bring him into the White House, which is smart politics, but also Baker was a very effective chief of staff. But then at the end, without Reagan being involved in any way, James Baker decided that he wanted to get out of the White House, and Donald Regan, who was the Secretary of Treasury, decided he wanted to get into the White House as Chief of Staff. And so they swapped places, and other staff people changed too. And Reagan wasn't even involved in the decisions, but the new staff basically screwed up on a constant basis. They just didn't have the same sense of what was politically shrewd and wise, and so they scheduled him into Bitburg and let him go on with it, even after they discovered that he was going to be going to a cemetery that had SS troops buried there. So one of the things that's most notable about Reagan is the degree to which his success was almost completely dependent upon his ability to project and articulate a unifying and ennobling vision. But it was a success and a vision which had almost no follow-through on his part and depended for its effectiveness on the quality of staff people he had around him. And when he had bad staff people, he really basically got himself in deep trouble. Witness the Iran-Contra scandal and the degree to which he almost got himself impeached by virtue of people who were acting illegally and trying to set up alternative forms of government, like a new CIA outside of the purview of Congress.
Mm. Well, you're just basically saying that he had handlers and he was an actor, and if they gave him the wrong script and set the wrong scene for him, then he was, he was a victim of that, whereas as opposed to being any grand actor with grand strategy.
Right. Except that I think it's important to recognize that the vision that Reagan articulated was a vision that he totally believed in and that he had been preaching for years. So I don't think it's fair to say that the vision was created by his handlers. I think that was his. I think that that's what made his life have purpose and meaning. I think he encapsulates this when he comes back from Moscow at the end of his administration when he signed a strategic arms treaty with Gorbachev. And he comes back and he tells the reporters on the plane, what a wonderful role to play. It's like being in a Cecil B. DeMille production. And he basically acknowledges that what has made this exciting for him is the role he can play. But I do think it's important to recognize that he identified with that role and that the vision he thought he was representing was one that he deeply believed in.
But the vision as translated into policy, you can go back and look at the polls. I'm not talking about the polls that showed him to be least popular president until I think this one, but at the time of the 83 recession. But you can also look at his policies and see how well they polled. People believed in him and liked him and thought it was morning in America when he was implementing policies that a majority of people in the U.S. didn't support. So
I agree. Yeah.
Well, that's the selling of the president and advertising instead of campaigning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Historian William Chafe, our guest this afternoon. His latest book, Private Lives, Public Consequences, Personality and Politics in Modern America. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk about purpose and meaning and times, moments of personal crisis in the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and how that shaped him as one of the great political leaders of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, King is such an extraordinary figure. You know, he's raised in a very bourgeois background. He's certainly experiencing racism when he hears his father called boy and is forced to ride in the back of a bus. But compared to the experience of lots of African Americans in the South, it was a relatively comfortable experience. And his dad basically raised him to go to Morehouse and to be a minister. And I think there's a lot of evidence that you know, he was essentially trying to please his father but also follow his own whims. So he decides to become a minister, but also at the price of getting his father to let him go to Crozier Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania and then on to Boston University to get a doctorate. And all of this kind of leads him to accepting a pastorate, but not at his dad's church, but rather in Montgomery at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, which is, of course, where Rosa Parks and Montgomery helps to catalyze and trigger the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955-56. And we now know, of course, that that was a long-standing movement, that Rosa Parks was simply the latest example of a person who was going to disobey the law, and because she was such a pivotal figure in the community, someone who could unite the community in a boycott. And that's how King gets invited as a newcomer to town, as kind of someone without the baggage of other ministers in town, to be the spokesman for the movement. And he does an extraordinarily good job of that. But I think the episode that is most notable for me, if we look at King in 1955, and then look at the rest, the next and last 13 years of his life, in the middle of 1 month after the boycott begins, almost every night he's getting threatening phone calls, harassing phone calls from Klan members, from White Citizens Council people. And one night, toward midnight, he gets a phone call threatening his wife and children, and it gets to him finally. I mean, he kind of collapses, and he talks about this, and he talks about pacing the kitchen and being almost without any resources and sort of turning and saying, I cannot handle this, God. I cannot handle this. Please, I am helpless. And then he talks about hearing this voice, an inner voice, saying, you must do what is right. You must do what is just. I will be with you. I will never leave you alone. I will never leave you alone. And suddenly he says an inner peace came to him. Now, this is a story which I'm sure, and as it's told over and over again by King, undoubtedly gets elaborated and in some ways almost begins to sound apocryphal. And yet, if you look at the way in which his life from that point forward is really sustained by the sense that he has embarked on a calling which is divinely inspired and that he has a personal relationship with this God who is going to stand with him no matter how difficult the times, no matter how terrible the torture, no matter how pernicious the persecution. This is someone who not only almost dies on at least one occasion and is threatened with assassination many, many times. But someone is also viciously persecuted by the FBI, which wiretaps his phone, which wiretaps his hotel rooms, which goes to the point of sending a tape recording of evidence that he is engaged in extramarital affairs and has been drunk, all of which is designed to basically humiliate him and destroy him. And his wife and he listen to this together, and it's accompanied by a message written in the FBI asking him, basically telling him that he has no alternative. You know what you must do to yourself, you fraudulent, abnormal, immoral person. And they're essentially asking him to commit suicide. And he gets through all that. He finds somehow an inner strength. And all the divisions that are taking place, all the fighting over the question of whether nonviolence is really the way to go, and he stays with it all the way. And he talks openly about the degree to which he is a person who has sinned, a person who is fragile. And he always comes back to sort of believing in a God who will forgive, who will make him strong and enable him to carry on. And I just can't find any way of explaining how he can deal with all of this without believing that some such event took place in his kitchen in 1955 that made his religion a personal religion rather than an intellectual one, which it had been up to that point.
Hmm. You know, one of the things I suspect most of us have wondered about leaders like these is how they handle the burdens of leadership in times of crisis, and how, you know, whether they do it well or they don't do it at all or they do it poorly.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, all these pressures, you know, to what extent does that affect one's mental well-being?
Well, I think it does affect one's mental well-being. I think that there are, as you know from having read the book, there are, I think that people like King and Kennedy are remarkable in the great degree to which they retain poise and equanimity and strength. But I also think that people like Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon are people who show the consequence of all this. And I think that they're certainly in the time of the anti-Vietnam War protests. Johnson was so desperately trying to create the Great Society and at the same time not be the first president to lose a war to communism. And he was basically projecting onto his enemies the most conspiratorial motives and calling them all communists. And, you know, his staff became very worried about his mental well-being. Was he really going to be able to handle this? And they talked to Lady Bird Johnson about it. So I think that was kind of one example of all these pressures getting to you. And then there was Nixon, mm-hmm. who had this almost schizophrenic personality of, on the one hand, being able to think about transforming world politics by going to China and being the first person to bring the United States and China back into dialogue since the Cold War began, but simultaneously was able to become so involved in vindictive and petty politics that he wanted to break into Democratic National Committee headquarters and stomp on his opponents. And, you know, there's a kind of really bizarre quality to the Nixon way of proceeding on these two levels almost simultaneously. And as Watergate develops and as he becomes more and more pinned into a corner and he has nowhere to go and he can't deceive the people anymore and the tapes come out, and people become really scared about his mental well-being. And his Secretary of Defense actually gives an order to the generals in the Pentagon saying that they are not to obey military orders from the White House without the Secretary of Defense's permission, because he's just scared to death what Nixon might try to do.
Mm.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. We have to wrap up now, I'm sorry to say, but what do you hope readers will take away from these essays, these profiles?
I hope they will take away two things. An appreciation for the fragility and delicacy of individual lives. An appreciation for the courage with which people overcome adversity. And an understanding of the fact that only when we really appreciate the full complexity of how people deal with problems in their lives do we have a clue as to how they're going to deal with the problems in the nation's life.
There we'll leave it. Professor Chafe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
William Chafe has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Private Lives, Public Consequences, Personality and Politics in Modern America. The publisher, Harvard University Press. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Time to find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here with Settlement Prices, Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a quiet day for the most part at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City. We did see some modest gains on the board across the complex. Leading the way was wheat in Kansas City as well as wheat in Minneapolis. That rallied on worries that wet weather in the U.S. Plains could lead to some planting delays earlier this spring. We also noted some wheat-soy spreading supporting wheat today as well. Let's go ahead and look at how the prices settled. We'll begin in Kansas City with the May contract. A high on the day of 422.5, a low of 413. Settling 422 up 7.75. July, a high of 428.5, a low of 418. Settling 427.75, up 9.25.